Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Today on Truth and Movies, here's Ewan. Mr. McGregor is Dr. Sleep in Mike Flanagan's Shining sequel.
I don't know about magic. I always called it The Shining.
Ken Loach delivers another slice of social realist drama in Sorry We Missed You.
You don't drive for us. You perform services.
And in Film Club, the Bates is back. Anthony Perkins returns for Psycho 2.
Norman Bates is judged restored to sanity.
All coming up in Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. Hello there, movie truthers. It's Michael Leader here, sitting in the host chair this week, sitting across from Hannah Woodhead of Little White Lies.
Hello.
And Anton Bettel.
Hello.
So, Anton, this is another Stephen King film out this week. We brought you back after Pet Sematary and It Chapter 2 this year.
It's strange. I've only actually ever read one Stephen King novel, but I keep seeing his films. So.
Well, it's a big film to talk about, Dr. Sleep. Should we just crack on with the reviews this week? No other business?
Yeah. I mean, I guess I can say that we've put the new issue to bed, so hopefully next week, or maybe the week after, we can tell you all about it.
Can you drop a clue? Is that within your jurisdiction to do that?
I might get sacked. I mean, I don't want to spoil the surprise for anyone. It's a bit of a banger. There's a lot in this issue, not just in the kind of front section, but in the back section. It's kind of
I thought they were all bangers, all of the cover.
They are, yeah. I say it for every issue. But this is my 10th one as well. So this is today, the 30th, is my 2-year anniversary of Little White Lies, and this is my 10th issue. So I think it feels even more special than usual for me. So hopefully next week we'll be able to tell you what it is.
Yes. And we're going to kick off this very special Hannah anniversary podcast with Dr. Sleep. Dr. Sleep continues the story of Danny Torrance 40 years after his terrifying stay at the Overlook Hotel in The Shining. Still irrevocably scarred by the trauma he endured as a child at the Overlook, Dan Torrance has fought to find some semblance of peace, but that peace is shattered when he encounters Abra, a teenager with her own powerful extrasensory gift.
When I was a kid, there was a place. A dark place. They closed it down and let it rot. But the things that lived there... they come back.
Hi. You can hear me. You're magic. Like me.
I don't know about magic. I always called it The Shining.
So, Anton, we've teed this up as bringing you back for another Stephen King film, but this isn't just a simple Stephen King film, is it? It's simultaneously an adaptation of Stephen King's own sequel to his Shining novel and a sequel to Stanley Kubrick's 1980 The Shining.
Yeah, it's like an impossible task for Mike Flanagan. It's very hard to believe he took it on because it's so hubristic. He's tackling what is the sequel to... what many people regard as one of the greatest horror novels ever written in 1977, but also a sequel to the film that many people, myself included, regard as one of the greatest horror films ever made in 1980. And the novel and the film are irreconcilable because Stephen King famously has completely disowned the film, will tell anyone who will listen to him, and has done for decades, how much he despises Kubrick's film. And the problem with a filmmaker approaching this material is they could try to adapt just the novel Dr. Sleep, which I might add is a sequel that was written only this decade. It's a very belated sequel as a book. He could focus entirely on the material that's in the book, which inevitably cannot be the same as the filmic universe that was presented in 1980 and can't continue directly from it, because in the film of The Shining, Kubrick made all kinds of changes to the plotting that, you know, leave characters dead who are still alive in Stephen King's universe. And the problem for anybody trying to approach this material is that if you decide to stick with Stephen King's words and not with the film, any film viewer inevitably is going to have the iconography of the 1980 film stuck in their head, and that is what they're going to expect. And I think Mike Flanagan has, in approaching this material, has made that attempt at reconciliation part of the kind of structure of his plotting. The film is about different groups trying to meet or mismatching with one another in search of something that will allow them to continue. We have the main character, Dan, who's now in his 40s, is when we first meet him, he's an alcoholic. He's using alcohol to suppress his shining powers because he's haunted by his past and just doesn't want those ghosts to keep returning to him. But he very quickly decides to change and engages in an AA program, goes clean, and immediately starts getting a vestige of his powers back. And this is kind of quite important because actually when Stephen King wrote the novel, The Shining, he was himself an alcoholic. He was an author and an alcoholic, like the father figure, like the father in The Shining. And he's now writing this sequel as someone who's a recovered alcoholic, looking back on his past. And in a sense, that plot is contained within the film. Dan, although he's not a writer, it's only his father who is a writer, does end up writing. He writes on the wall because as soon as he regains his powers, this young woman, Abra, starts communicating him with him through messages written on the wall of his apartment, even though, in fact, his room, I should say, it's not an apartment, even though she's hundreds of miles away on the other side of America, because her powers are, in fact, quite a bit stronger than his. We also have him looking back to his own distant past, and we know that at some point he's going to have to return to his past and address all these unresolved issues that he has. And there's another group, a group of people that had The Shining or something like The Shining, who have taken the decision to change into something else that requires eating the fears and pain of those who have The Shining. So they're a group of kind of vampiric ex-Shining members who go around looking for people with The Shining and absorbing them, and especially children who have The Shining. And so, in a sense, what this means is that the film is kind of doing what all sequels do. It's retreading old ground. It even reconstructs the old Overlook Hotel. We go back to the Overlook Hotel. I don't think that's a spoiler because it's all over the trailers and you really can't miss it. And we also have lots of ghosts that are familiar from the first film. But at the same time, it's moving off in its own direction. It's really, we think this is about Dan, and in a sense it is about Dan, but it's about Dan handing over the baton to someone in a younger generation. And the focus by the end is very much on her rather than on him. And we sense that she's a bit more like a character from X-Men or indeed from the film, from Paul McGuigan's Push. In fact, her story really reminded me of Paul McGuigan's Push, which is about people with kind of mutant powers. Each person has a different power, and together they use them to form a kind of very elaborate con trick that you could only do with these powers. And something like that happens in this, and there's even a character whose powers are referred to, the person who has these powers is referred to as a pusher, and that's clearly an allusion to Push. And I thought that, you know, for the most part, it's, given how hubristic the project was, it's pretty amiable and likable as a horror film. It never quite went where I was expecting it to go. And I think one of the things I most liked about it, although this might annoy a lot of other viewers, is that when it did revisit the past, in the scenes where you go back to the Overlook Hotel or where literally all the ghosts from the original film return in one form or another, so the bartender and the Grady twins, who now really are called twins even though they weren't twins in the original film, and the woman in the bath, whenever they come back, they're locked in a loop. They just repeat exactly the same lines and exactly the same behaviours that they did in 1980. And I like the idea that the film allows us to look at the past, but it also acknowledges that the past is now frozen and dead and nothing ever is going to change there. And that is the way that the film is able to move forward and do something else, by acknowledging that. And I think that's quite a clever play.
It's interesting. Already within your description of the plot there, we see that this is, I'm thinking of the marketing of this, which leans heavily on the iconography of the Stanley Kubrick film. People who may go in expecting something as stripped back and as cold as just sort of raw in the way it terrifies you as the original Shining film might be a bit baffled by the amounts of lore and extra plot that's there.
And it's a cross-country film. It's like, it's not claustrophobic. The characters go all over the place in this film.
And some, you know, if you were feeling uncharitable, you could say this is almost like the Star Wars prequels, where Stephen King is interested in exploring the midichlorians of The Shining. So we're introduced to this steam that Shining adepts.
And you also have Yoda-like guru masters who guide characters through their powers.
It's really a very different beast, The Shining. Hannah, what did you make of this? Are you a fan of the original film?
Oh, yeah, I'm a big fan of The Shining. Yeah. It was the first Kubrick film I watched, and it still has a very sort of, you know, big place in my heart. And I actually rewatched it after watching Doctor Sleep, which probably didn't benefit Doctor Sleep massively. Because watching it again last night or the night before last, I was struck by, you know, it still holds up. It's still, you know, incredible film. Whereas Doctor Sleep didn't really do a great deal for me. I think also when you make a sequel that's half an hour longer than the original film, extended cuts excluded, that to me immediately is a warning sign that you've done something wrong if you think that you can make a longer film than Stanley Kubrick.
He's pretty good at making long films.
So yeah, I was not impressed by it being 2.5 hours. I think that it could lose half an hour very easily, this film. It's very unwieldy, in my opinion. I think there are so many kind of narrative threads going on. There's a whole sequence where we're kind of, where Rebecca Ferguson's character has gone off to find this new recruit for their team. And it's just, there's just so many moments like that where you're like, well, did we need to see this? Like, we could have taken, you know, 10 minutes off here and it would have felt tighter and probably a lot scarier to me. There's a lot of exposition that goes on where they have to, you know, really explain what's going on, because there's so many details that I think in The Shining were just kind of left to your own imagination. And one of the things I think is really interesting reading up on Stephen King's problems with The Shining is that he felt that the film shied away from the supernatural elements of his story, and that it was much more ambiguous as to what was the root of Jack Torrance's madness. Whereas I think the film is not that ambiguous, to be honest. I think it is pretty clear that The Shining is real. But this is, you know, Dr. Sleep makes no kind of bones about it. It's like, nope, the supernatural is real and this is how it's going to play out. And for me, yeah, I felt like it was a very bloated, not very scary, kind of predictable, very much reminded me of the Halloween reboot that we got last year, in that it's taking all this iconography from this film you loved when you were younger and repackaging it for, I don't know, it feels like cynical marketing reasons, in my opinion.
That's interesting.
And also, I think one of the biggest things I got from watching this was that the reason The Shining is so great is because the iconic images that we associate with it, like the elevators and the Grady sisters and the woman in the bathtub, is that you see them for kind of glimpses at a time and it becomes more terrifying because you're like, oh, when are they going to pop up next? Whereas in Doctor Sleep, they were there all the time. It was like, oh, there they go again. It lost a lot of its impact for me because I was like waiting for the next kind of instance to come along and, you know.
This is almost like the conversation we had last week on this podcast about Terminator Dark Fate, where it's a belated sequel which is trying to bring back an element of the iconography but tells a new story. The thing with Dr. Sleep that I find so fascinating and intriguing is that it is not even necessarily in the same genre as The Shining. It's not psychological twisted horror. It may use a lot of the same iconography. It may use the same music cues at certain points. But it is more like, as you say, Anton, something like an X-Men origin story. It plays like a supernatural thriller with these special powers, the ragtag bunch of, let's just call them shining vampires, led by Rebecca Ferguson, who looks like she's walked out of an 80s Aerosmith concert.
They've all got really silly names as well, which is
all superhero
King's
names,
thing,
you know? Like,
but she's called Rose the Hat, and there's Snake by Andy and Crow Daddy.
Or Dr. Sleep, which is what Danny Torrance, the moniker he adopts, because he uses his shining, because his limited shining capabilities are more empathic. He's able to sense when somebody in the hospital he's working is going to die and can help them bridge the gap between the living and the dead.
And the idea that, you know, what he chooses to do is to help those who are dying to pass on. is such a perfect metaphor for what this sequel is trying to do to The Shining. And
It is interesting because you say cynical, Hannah. It's almost like, and this is where we can talk about Mike Flanagan, maybe, Anton. There's something here where I can see the wheels turning behind the screen of trying to satisfy everybody in this horrible equation of Stephen King, Kubrick, fans, horror fans, people who read King novels, people who watch King movies and what they expect from that. And Mike Flanagan is at the heart of it. And he's somebody who has come out of the independent horror boom of the last 10 years. And this is his, in terms of feature films, his big stepping out party. And Anton, could you say something about his work? And mentioned hubristic earlier.
In a way, hubristic, we should say. But in a way, one of the things that he definitely doesn't try to do in Dr. Sleep is he doesn't try to look like Kubrick. Mm. I mean, he rebuilds the sets of the Overlook, but he doesn't shoot them in the same way that Kubrick did. And it's quite clear that he doesn't. He's chosen different actors to replace the characters from the first film, who I think quite deliberately don't quite look like those characters. And I think it's that, you know, one might say uncharitably, he just couldn't find the right cast. But I think actually, I don't think that. I think the opposite. I think he's tried to go for people that don't look the same as those characters because he's trying to distance himself and not trying to be exactly the same as the original film, even though he's treading over similar territories. And, you know, it should be said that Mike Flanagan actually is an expert in this realm because what Mike Flanagan has done in film after film after film, if you look at his first film, Absentia, if you look at Oculus, if you look at Ouija, Origin of Evil, possibly one of the best sequels to a crap film ever made, and TV's The Haunting of Hill House, what he specializes in is adults returning to their childhood trauma. And that is exactly what this film is addressing. Mm-hmm. And I think he kind of knows what he's doing. I mean, in a way, Chapter 2 earlier this year was dealing in similar themes, except that Mike Flanagan has, I know you're going to disagree with this, Hannah, but I think Mike Flanagan has real characters. He has characters that I found I could believe in and that I quite liked. And who weren't, I mean, this, it would have been very easy to make this a simple story of good and evil, but actually, I don't know whether we're meant to think of Abra as a straightforwardly good character. It's clear that she has capacity to do terrible things. She delivers the film's most sadistic lines. She's actually much more sadistic than the cultists who are pursuing her. And I think it's that kind of complexity of characterization, which is quite typical of Mike Flanagan's work and which kept me diverted. And I must personally, unlike Hannah, although I do agree, I think anything over 90 minutes is too long for a horror film, just as a general principle. And I think The Shining, which is a perfect horror film to me, if it were by anyone else, I would regard as too long. It should not, because it clearly is over 90 minutes, but it's one of the few that gets away with it. I don't think that I felt bored by this. It's not that I think it, I don't think it even approaches the level of The Shining. I think The Shining is a much better film, and I'm not even going to enter a debate about that. But I did enjoy it, and I certainly wasn't bored by it, despite its length.
Mm-hmm. And you were bored, Hannah?
Yeah. I mean, when I wasn't bored was when Kylie Curran was on screen, who plays Abra. I think she's amazing. She's really, really good. And I'm pretty sure that she was someone that they just found, you know.
It's her first film.
Yeah, she's not a kind of pro. So that's pretty incredible to come just fresh out the gate. And it's a pretty hard role that she's playing, you know, especially picking up from The Shining as this poor kid who, you know, was born however many decades after that film. But maybe that's good in a way because she doesn't feel the pressure that I assume a lot of people would feel with following up one of the greatest horror films of all time. And actually, I think Ewan McGregor, I'm not really a Ewan McGregor fan, but I think he does do a pretty decent job in this. Mm-hmm. But yeah, Rebecca Ferguson, I thought
Rebecca Ferguson was really terrible. I thought it was a good use of her. Since that breakout role in the Mission Impossible film, you know, films, she's been kind of awkwardly placed, hasn't she, in cast. But in this one, I thought she used her physicality. There's one line that one of her victims says to her, which is, "You're the most beautiful woman I've ever seen," which is, I think she does look like a 10-year-old girl's vision of the most beautiful woman they've ever seen. And she has that almost spider-like, spindly, fairy tale baddie look to her.
I think maybe I would have found this a more terrifying proposition if it was just her, if she didn't have this kind of band of, you know, cronies working for her.
Including the giant from Twin Peaks, right?
Yeah.
Who turns up whenever you need a creepy tall guy.
Yeah, bless him. Oh, he doesn't have much of a look in this.
And I think it's fair to say it's not terrifying. If you're going into this looking for a scary movie, I don't think you're going to find that.
Apart from the one scene with bless him, little Jacob Tremblay, who, again, I'm not a huge fan of, which is a horrible thing to say about a small child, but he's in this in a minor role, and I do think the scene that he's in is very, not terrifying, but disturbing. Mm-hmm. And I kind of maybe wanted more of that. I think I wanted the film to push the disturbing elements more. You know, I mean, I guess I think that's a problem, unfortunately, now with adaptations of Stephen King books. They're quite afraid to get into the really dark stuff that Stephen King isn't afraid to get mm-hmm. into in his books. I think I just, if I'm going to have to watch a 2.5 hour horror film, I want to be genuinely scared.
Mm-hmm. That's a fair point. I think even when we talked about It Chapter 2, we talked about long horror films.
Was that the same 2.5 hours? Because I've not seen that yet.
Very similar. Dr. Sleep is a better 2.5 hour movie. I really didn't like It Chapter 2.
So.
Well, we have a whole podcast about that, don't we, Anton? Yeah, Anton, but what scores would you give Dr. Sleep? So in anticipation, enjoyment in retrospect.
In anticipation, I'd say it's kind of somewhere in the middle, because I just love The Shining so much, and I think there's no conceivable way you can outdo it. I don't think it does try to outshine it. I think it just tries to reconcile itself mm-hmm. to it. And for enjoyment, I'd say also 3. I didn't love it, but I was surprised how much I didn't hate it. Mm-hmm. And in retrospect, I think because of the games that it plays with its status as a sequel, the way it keeps presenting you with metaphors for what it's trying to do to The Shining, I think I'd give it 4. I found that interesting mm-hmm. to think about afterwards.
Hannah?
Probably 3 in anticipation, just because, you know, I think it's an intriguing premise, even if one that should be regarded with, I think, a very healthy dose of scepticism. And then enjoyment, and in retrospect, probably a 2 for me. I just... Mm-hmm. You know, I think there have been better horror films in the last year. I think there have probably been better Stephen King films in the last year, which is... You know what? No. Michael's just shaking his head at me. No, he's completely right, yeah. I mean, it is the best out of a bad bunch this year in terms of... We've had Pet Sematary, which was very bad...
And It Chapter 2, I suppose.
So
I think this is best
good.
In class for 2019 King movies.
And that one that's just come out on Netflix.
Oh, there's a Netflix one, isn't
there?
Yeah,
the tall grass one. It just sounds
like
such
I did
a
see
silly...
that.
Is it any good?
It's okay.
Let's see. It's not been a vintage year, really, for Stephen King adaptations.
So many of them. And it's funny, this is the one that he doesn't have a cameo in because he's both in Pet Sematary and, and It Chapter 2.
That's interesting, considering how involved he was in this.
Maybe that's, yeah, I wonder why. For me, it's, I think, 3's down the line, but I found this such an intriguing watch and such a surprising watch. I was never bored. And I'm a fan of Mike Flanagan's work. I think he's one of the best filmmakers we have in the genre, and seeing him find his way through that almost impossible task and inject some of himself in there, including his own Easter eggs. We mentioned Jacob Tremblay. Mike Flanagan brings back some of his own stable of actors into this, like Bruce Greenwood, who you know from Gerald's Game and his previous films.
Oh, yeah.
So there's a lot in there that's quite fun.
And for anyone who's seen Gerald's Game and remembers the one scene in that film that's absolutely impossible to watch, it's so unpleasant, well, that gets a little return in this.
Exactly.
That was a good bit in the film. That was like genuinely quite horrific.
That was so hard to watch.
Yeah. That's what I mean. I mean, I didn't like The Haunting of Hill House, mm-hmm. which is weird because it sounds very much like my kind of thing. But I think I might give Mike Flanagan another chance for some of his earlier work.
I think Anton will agree with me. Go and watch Ouija Origin.
And he seems like a very nice guy as well, I have to say. He did a little intro for our film, and he just, you know, I think, you know, as a critic, you're always kind of supposed to, like, be a bit detached. But when a filmmaker's nice, it just does make me kind of look upon their work a little bit more favourably, because I'm like, you're a nice person. You deserve to be making films.
And we're going to go from a film by a very nice person to a film by an ornery old bloke called Ken Loach. Let's see what you make of that, Hannah, as we talk about Sorry We Missed You. Ken Loach follows the Cannes Prize-winning eye, Daniel Blake, with this exploration of the contemporary world of work, the gig economy, and the challenges faced by one family trying to hold it all together. Here's a clip.
I'd rather work on my own now and be my own boss.
Have you ever been on the dole?
No. I've got my pride. I'd rather starve first.
Music to my ears, Ricky. Henry was right. You are a trooper. Let's just get a few things straight at the start, though, shall we? You don't get hired here. You come on board. We like to call it onboarding. You don't work for us. You work with us. You don't drive for us. You perform services. There's no employment contracts. There's no performance targets. You meet delivery standards. There's no wages, but fees. Is that clear?
Yeah.
Clear?
Yeah, it sounds all right, yeah. Good, yeah.
No clocking on, you become available. You sign up with us, you become an owner, driver, franchisee. Master of your own destiny, Ricky. You up for that?
Yeah, I've been waiting for an opportunity like this for ages.
A clip from Sorry We Missed You There. Hannah, we should just say up top that every time a new Ken Loach film comes out, the same divisive arguments happen all the time. Of course, we can separate the cause from the craft of the film. That's what we're talking about here, right? But let's talk about Sorry We Missed You. Were you excited going into this film? What do you make of Ken Loach nowadays?
I did like I, Daniel Blake. I think this is very similar in the ground that he's treading. And I very much doubt that any of us disagree with Ken Loach and that this gig economy and this mm-hmm. 0 hours economy is killing people. Mm-hmm. That is an irrefutable fact. I absolutely, yeah, 100%, I'm on board. I come from a working class family, a working class area of Sheffield. And yeah, I know families like this who are living hand to mouth on next to nothing. And my mum was stuck in the same minimum wage job for 4 years and she hated it. And she was incredibly depressed and struggling to feed her family. So I totally 100% not only sympathise, I've lived through this, I understand. But for me, I personally do not think it is enough for a film to have to come from an important, part of our society, especially not a fiction film. I think if this was a documentary, which was, going out and meeting these people and going to these companies who undoubtedly would not talk, I think I'd probably be a lot more interested and a lot more forgiving, because translating this into quote-unquote art for me means that Ken Loach is trying to do something beyond just point out what the plight is. He's, and that's the thing a lot of people have said about this film. Oh, why does art have to be pretty or poetic? Why can't it just be enough that it has, a strong social message? But if you're going to make a film like this about this very, very real world issue, why make it a fiction, an art film, if you're not going to add anything else to it? I don't really understand kind of what the benefit is to Ken Loach to make a film. Because he's made documentaries before, has he not?
He has. He made Spirit of 45 a few years ago about the welfare state. Yeah.
So exactly. I think it would be a more effective story if he went straight to the source rather than creating this fictionalised. It almost feels like a soap opera. It's so kind of laden with misery and laden with these very extreme characters. So you have, they almost seem like stereotypes. You have, the caring wife who is literally a carer. It's what she does, she cares. That's what she actually says in the film. You have, the hardworking salt of the earth dad. You have the really horrible, angry boss who I think is one of the film's high points. And it seems to paint people with such broad strokes. And I think people are a lot more, I've said this before, I think I said this about Joker as well, I think people are a lot more nuanced and a lot more interesting than this film really wants them to be.
Mm-hmm. I suppose that's a sticking point with some people, is when critics ask for more nuance in their social realist films, they don't mean nuance on the political points, they just mean nuance in the telling.
Exactly, yeah, nuance in the characters, Mm-hmm. And it's not just about the character of Ricky, who's the protagonist, it's about everyone else in the film, how, they're reduced to to what they do, and that for me is such a kind of reductive way of looking at the world. I guess maybe Loach is making a comment here on, how the gig economy forces you to just become another number on the system in someone's garage where they're delivering the parcels. Maybe this is his intent. But for me, it's very hard to connect characters if there's all that I know about them is that they have a job and the job is very bad, I'm not saying that this film needs to be, some Terrence Malick-esque sweeping portrait of the northern world. I'm just saying I'd like something with a little more kind of life to it. It feels really soulless.
Right, and I suppose Ken Loach's status as pretty much our only polemicist of this sort of film, who makes this sort of film, he's a lightning rod for these conversations. It feels like many other European filmmaking nations have a tradition where many directors work in this area. Whereas Ken Loach and Paul Laverty, the screenwriter, have a monopoly on Northern Misery.
And we know why that is. We know that it's because it is, if you're a working class filmmaker, it's very hard to get a film made. And particularly if you're a woman, you don't, there are not a lot of working class women making films in the UK about the experience of being working class. And I think really me not liking this film and thinking this film is quite clumsily constructed, it's not a diss against Ken Loach. It's more of a diss that this is the best we've got. Like, have we not got people out there who are wanting to make films and tell their stories who can do it with maybe a bit more, you know, a sort of more interesting lens than Ken Loach, who's been essentially, come on, like, he's been making the same film for quite a while now. Mm-hmm. And I think with I, Daniel Blake, it works well and it kind of catalyzed a whole nation to be more open to these issues. A, because it had a really, really great cast. I think that everyone in that film was very, very good, which I don't think is necessarily the case in Sorry We Missed You. But B, I think maybe we were more optimistic as a nation at the time. You think about all the time that's passed since I, Daniel Blake, and how little has changed. To me, there is a sense of Sorry We Missed You is the kind of film that politicians will watch, middle-class, upper-middle-class people will watch and go, yes, this is very important, can't believe this is happening, and then nothing will change. So, you know, it's all very well to make these films and to say, like, yeah, I'm raising awareness, but I'm like, well, what are you going to do with that awareness? So we need to actually change things, and I just don't, and I don't know if it's enough to have a message without anything kind of, you know, going back in. Like, I mean, is profits from this going to help people who are on these 0 hours contracts? I just don't. I sound like I'm on my soapbox now, but I'm genuinely frustrated by the idea that we have this fiction film about a world, and is it actually going to do anything to help these people beyond making them quote unquote seen?
I fully believe that Ken Loach believes in the cause and will try, as he did with I, Daniel Blake, the release of this film. I'm sure there'll be some component of local grassroots activism.
I hope so, and I hope it's more successful than the I, Daniel Blake grassroots.
But what strikes me now is for Ken Loach and Paul Laverty, who've been collaborating on these films now for, oh gosh, 15, 20 years. I mean, Ken Loach's been, since Ken Loach came back, roaring back in the late 80s with his period of films from Raining Stones onwards, and Paul Laverty, they've worked together from Looking for Eric onwards. Their tools are just blunted now. It's horrifying. There is a compelling pull to the precarity of the 0 hour contract, to the gig economy, that when you see it played out dramatically is compelling and is quite terrifying, more terrifying than anything we saw in Doctor Sleep. But there are whole swathes of this script where it feels like Paul Laverty is copied and pasted from a Commenters Free article on that topic.
You know what else I think is very interesting about this film and about the fact that it's set in the northeast of England? There are not a lot of people of colour in this film, and the people that are having to do these 0 hours jobs, there are a lot of, you know, white working class men who have to do it, but there are a lot of people of colour, minorities, who are having to take these jobs. It doesn't really represent the UK we live in. It's, you know, I think that it's a much more vibrant and diverse and interesting place than Sorry We Missed You wants to make it look.
Anton, what do you make of this film?
You know, I heard our Marxist comedian Alexei Sale on the radio the other night doing some stand-up, and in the middle of a joke, he just launched into a disquisition about British imperial incursions into Iran in the 20th century. And he talked very seriously about this for some time and then paused and said, and when Corbyn becomes prime minister, all stand-up will be like this. And in a way, that's what I think Sorry We Missed You is like. It's like that disquisition, but without the joke framing it. In that, it's just like Hannah says, and Ken Loach has been in the news recently because he joined the kind of bandwagon of directors who've accused Marvel films of not being cinema. Now, I don't really want to get into that debate, but if you're going to start talking about one film being cinema and another not, then it does raise the question, what is it about this that makes it cinema? Because it certainly contains a lot of information which it presents to us in a fairly didactic fashion, but it doesn't really, there just didn't seem to me to be a whole bunch of art to it. There's certainly no poetry. And it really is possible to tell stories like this with a great deal of poetry, because Lynn Ramsey and Andrea Arnold do it really, really, really well. And I would much rather watch their films than this film. I must say, I didn't hate this film, but I just felt like it was blank and it was something I would have happily watched on TV while not paying much attention to it. And there's a scene where the main character's wife, Abby the carer, walks past a street sign. And if you look, you can see that the street sign reads Coronation Street. And to me, that absolutely sets the tone for the film. It feels like you're watching a soap opera. And the material that it's dealing with is so important that it deserves to be better presented so that more people will pay attention to it. Because I just found that it's kind of bludgeoning watching these films. And although I think entertainment is a complex thing, it's not that any one film is straightforwardly fun, and we all find entertainment where we want to find it. There's just something about the way this, and I also think I, Daniel Blake, are framed, which makes them deeply unpalatable to watch. They just don't feel like real films. And so I think that was my main problem. However, there are some things I liked about it. The company for which Ricky Turner starts working as a non-contract deliverer is called Parcels Delivered Fast, I think. And you see the initials PDF. And in a sense, PDF is that's an acronym that we're used to from another context. And what the film does is it shows the dehumanization of these workers, where they're reduced to digital programs, not unlike PDFs. It's clear that his employer, Maroney, who we heard in the clip, all he cares about is the scanner that he hands to them, which collects a whole bunch of digital data. He doesn't care about his employees as people. He cares about the little boxes that they tick on the information that's being collected on them by the scanner. And what we're really seeing is a dehumanizing process where all these workers are becoming part of a delivery machine. And what I think the film is trying to do, and actually doesn't do badly at all, is it's trying to rehumanize these characters by showing them, not just showing Ricky at work, but then showing Ricky in the few hours he has when he's off work, because he works very long hours, at home and in his family life. And his family life, partly because of his absence and his wife's absence, because of the pressures of their work, his family life becomes more and more fractured as the film goes on. And his son, who's rebellious and who we're at first led to believe is going to be just a vandal and a hooligan, but we start realizing actually is quite politicized and also has artistic aspirations and is actually quite good with his artistic aspirations. Seb, the son, starts rebelling and creating friction and gets thrown out of school, and there's no one really at home to look after him, and he's getting in trouble with the police. And all of this, you can see all of these different problems spiraling out of what really is the one problem, which is the problem of employment and work hours and the amount that the workers are being paid. And I did like the performances. I liked actually the performances of all four of the family members. Okay. I thought the daughter, Lisa, who's played by, let me make sure I get this name correct, it's Katie Proctor,
yeah,
I thought was really very good, and I don't believe I've seen her in anything before.
Well, Ken Loach tends to cast non-professionals, yeah.
There just is something missing from this film. I guess in a way, the title, Sorry We Missed You, talks about that. It is about essentially an absent father, but there's also an absent film. I just wish there were more to it than what there is, because what we have is a bunch of data, but we don't have some kind of artistic program that connects all those points of data together, and that's what I really want from a film.
Yeah. Yeah. Hannah, what scores would you give Sorry We Missed You?
I feel like I've been a real downer this week. Again, I think it's probably a 3-2-2. I think I appreciate it more having heard Anton speak so eloquently on it. I think maybe I am a bit harsh on old Ken Loach. I don't know. He doesn't need me to defend him. He's got plenty of people who are very, very willing to go to bat for him. And I do agree that I think it's a very important issue, and I do hope that a film can have the power to influence people who have the power to change. But at the same time, if we're to believe that every person who has the power to change things is like Mulaney and is a nasty bastard, they're not gonna be touched by a film like this. They're not gonna see it and think that they are part of the problem. So yeah, I'm just an old cynic.
Anton?
Probably 3-3-3, I would say. Yeah.
I agree with you, Hannah. It's 3-2-2. But let us know what you make of Sorry We Missed You or Doctor Sleep if you go and see them this weekend at the usual channels, at Truth and Movies on Twitter, truthandmovies at tcolondon.com via email. And of course, there's the comments page at lwlies.com/podcast. Up next, though, we have Film Club, which is another related sequel, Psycho 2.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Released and set over 20 years after Alfred Hitchcock's classic proto-slasher Psycho, this sequel sees Norman Bates, after years of treatment in a mental institution for the criminally insane, come home to run the Bates Motel. Also returning is Vera Miles as the woman who is still haunted by her sister's brutal murder and the ominous motel where it all occurred many years ago.
On the basis of the staff report, Norman Bates is judged, restored to sanity, and is ordered released forthwith.
What about his victims? Don't they have any say? Can you restore them?
Madam, please sit down. This matter is being represented by the district attorney.
Your Honor, my name is Mrs. Lila Loomis. I have a petition here signed by 743 people against Norman Bates' release, including the relatives of the seven people he murdered. Doesn't that give me the right to speak out?
Has the district attorney advised Mrs. Loomis about her rights in this matter?
Yes, Your Honor. I explained that her petition had no effect on these proceedings.
Have you explained to her that this hearing is a matter of law and not a motion?
Don't you realize
they're
going to release a homicidal
maniac? Mrs. Loomis, I'm going to ask you to sit down or I'll have the bailiff remove you from this courtroom. If you have any further questions, please discuss them with the district attorney after this hearing.
Why bother? It's all too obvious. Our courts protect the criminals, not their victims.
Yes, that's a clip from Psycho 2 there, Vera Miles reprising her role as Lila Loomis. Let's see some comments from listeners. We have The Futurist saying he recalled going to see it with much trepidation, but was greatly surprised and spellbound by the twists and take on the happenings after the classic. The ending was highly satisfying. Director Franklin was a Hitchcock fan and he did the master proud. Abner Pastol says, brilliant film, one of my favourite sequels. And Pardeep Sahota agrees, one of the great sequels. Stuart Hoskin said, unfortunately, he managed to somehow see Psycho 2 before the original, so the twist was completely spoilt for him. I guess both twists, really, the fact that the murder in the shower and also the identity of mother. Yevgeny Karavansky says, surprisingly good, Vera Miles even better in this one than the first one. And David Hughes says, it's about as perfect as a belated sequel can be, and Psycho 3 is not too bad either. I haven't seen Psycho 3. That's one that Perkins directed himself. We talk about belated sequels. How's this for a bit of a mind-melting thing? So this film came out 23 years after Psycho. Dr. Sleep comes out nearly 40 years after The Shining. And it just feels like the gap between the 80s and now feels like nothing, but the gap between the 60s and the 80s feels huge, doesn't it?
It really does.
So Anton going from Psycho to Psycho 2, was this a first watch for you? Had you seen this one before?
Or, I, you know, the reputation, saw this, but I saw it only recently. I saw it about 2 years ago, mm-hmm. or a year ago. And I must say, I also love this. I've been debating whether I'm going to commit an act of absolute sacrilege on air or not, but I am. Although the original Hitchcock Psycho, which came out in 1960, is revered, and I think rightly revered as one of the most influential horror films ever made, if it's a horror film, the most influential murder films, I don't actually rate the film from the point at which the car is sunk in the bog. Mm-hmm. I think from that moment, the film falls apart, that almost all that anyone ever remembers about the film is the scenes leading up to that. And I think leading up to that moment, which is about half the film, it is perfect. It's absolutely perfect. And at that point, it kind of falls apart and the film doesn't really have any point and doesn't know what to do with its characters anymore and loses quite a lot of its tension, which the tension is built so carefully to that moment. This film doesn't have any flab like that. this film really, really is wound very, very, very tight. And a little bit like Dr. Sleep, it's fully aware of the reputation that the original has, and it keeps returning to it while trying to break free from it. All of this is instantiated, actually, in the character of Norman Bates. Norman Bates is now reformed. He's been released from a psychiatric institution, and we get the impression that he really does want to be a new, better person. He's modernizing, which is what a sequel should do, mm-hmm. but he keeps getting drawn back to his old ways. And there's all the changes here are rung. The film opens actually with the notorious shower scene from the original film, which is in black and white, and then shifts very quickly to colour so that we can see that's one change. There's a scene where we see Norman Bates walking into a diner where some characters are playing arcade games, which, yeah. of course, wouldn't have existed in the 60s. And he looks so out of place next to them because he, of course, has aged since mm-hmm. and has been in prison since the 60s. And although the flushing toilet that was glimpsed in the original Psycho was, that had never been seen before on screen, now we get a toilet that literally regurgitates blood all over the floor. It's much more extreme. And although the famous shower scene never actually features any nudity mm-hmm. in the original film, here we have a quite contrived shower sequence in which there's full-on 80s TNA. Mm-hmm. And I really do think what that's doing is showing just how times have changed, because that is one of the main themes of the film. And of course, the genre that Psycho influenced more than any other is the slasher genre, and it's in the 80s that the slasher genre came into its fore, like really, really, really became the thing that was in every cinema that mm-hmm. you went to. And so it's strange to see this old hand return in the 80s, the era of the slasher, and find his way through a world in which he's not quite familiar, and find that actually it's very difficult to escape from the burden of the past that he has. And it is such a twisty film, and the twists really are unguessable and clever.
Yes. I think it has so much fun as well with that. I love when there's a scene quite early in the film where he has Meg Tully's character around, and she's handing him the the butcher's knife, saying, "Why don't you take this knife?" And we know that this is referencing some of the brutal murders in the first film, but of course the dramatic irony that she doesn't know, and you don't want to give this character a knife because we know the legacy that you're playing on there.
And that's it's a very weird dynamic because he's conflicted. Mm-hmm. We know that there's a kind of double aspect to him. There's the nice guy that we see, but we know what he's capable of because of the first film. And as viewers, we're also conflicted because we want him to recover. Mm-hmm. We want him to get better, but we also want to watch a Psycho film in which lots of people are slashed in front of our eyes. And
it manages to get to the heart of something that's quite appealing about Anthony Perkins' performance, because he was so boyish in Psycho, so innocent. And in this one, now he's older, he has a bit of Jimmy Stewart sort of golly gosh sort of aspect to him. So we want him to get better. But of course, now, if we're viewing it through the eyes of an 80s slasher crowd, we want those gruesome deaths, don't we?
And he's very, his crooked smile is incredible. It's very, very difficult smile to read. And he's so melancholic in this. It's because he is really an old man who's just emerged in a world that he doesn't understand anymore.
Hannah, did you love it?
Yeah, I did. I think this is what I wanted Dr. Sleep to be. Uh-huh. I think it's a great film about trauma and about madness and about gaslighting. There's a lot of woman-on-man gaslighting.
A rare male gaslighting film, yeah.
Yeah, no, I actually really liked it. I think the big kind of twist is a lot of fun. And it's a good small town movie, you know. You get to see Norman Bates just like trying to be a fry cook, trying to run a motel, you know. I think it's, to say I'd never heard of this film until about a week ago, which probably outs me as a terrible film critic. And I think anyone who didn't know about this would be kind of sceptical, like, Psycho 2, really? Did anyone want that? And the answer is yes, it's very good. I think it's the rare instance of making a sequel that doesn't try at all to be the new Psycho. It just kind of does its own thing. It's not like a straight up horror film. It's not, you know, it's just building on kind of the mythology that was created, and also treating that as a mythology and kind of, you know, exploring the psychology of Norman Bates. Mm-hmm. And I think that Anthony Perkins, obviously, you know, we've already discussed it, he is amazing in this, and I think that Vera Miles and Meg Tilly are great as well. I think it is just a really enjoyable, fairly short movie. I think it's 1 hour 50.
I think it's even shorter than that, maybe 1 hour 40.
Yeah.
Is it shorter than the original Psycho?
It flew by, mm-hmm. I have to say. Yeah.
Still 10 minutes too long,
still
though.
Still 10 minutes too long. But I do think the end of it is very good as well. The last half hour is...
The final 20-odd minutes where really... I had seen a couple of the deaths from this film excerpted in GIF form, particularly the final... Way finally kills mother, and they're such satisfying gif-able moments, but if you're waiting for those to come up, you'll be waiting a long time.
Yeah.
It really goes off the hook at the end.
It's about, you know, this man who is very disturbed, trying to kind of reconcile his past and trying to move forward. And I don't want to get all like social commentary on Psycho 2, but you know, criminal reform's a really hard thing. You know, if you've been in the system for 20 years, how do you come out and live a normal life? Stephen King explores that in Shawshank Redemption. It all comes back to Stephen King. But I would highly recommend that anyone who isn't familiar with this goes and checks it out. We had so many comments about mm-hmm. how great this film was, which really, I think, the most comments for any film we've done on Film Club. People love Psycho 2.
And the real tragedy of the film is that when he comes out at the beginning, when he's released, he really genuinely is reformed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And unfortunately, it's all these other people that keep imposing his past back on him that create the problem.
Yeah, it's true. They can't just let him, you know, try again. Not that I'm saying that someone who murders three women should necessarily be given a second chance, but I think it does a really good job of exploring his trauma, and the shadow of Mrs. Bates kind of looms so large in this film, and he's trying to get away from it, bless him, and just can't. Everyone wants to talk to him about his bloody mother.
Mm-hmm.
Must be exhausting being Norman Bates.
And it just has that delicious, as you mentioned earlier, Anton, that delicious metatextual level where we'll always be remaking these stories. We'll be, and this was literally them pulling Anthony Perkins out of the cupboard wherever he was and saying, please just be Norman Bates again. And he's like, do you want me to just do the same thing again? Maybe I want to go and do other roles and other projects. But no, as we've just done with Dr. Sleep, as we'll keep doing with these films.
I should just add, though, that originally it was going to be Christopher Walken. This was mm-hmm. going to be a straight to DVD film. And Perkins read the script and said, I am in this. And that's what raised
that's
the film's
so good.
Profile.
Because, yeah. I mean, I think he does do this perfect job of, like, still having that kind of... There's something slightly off about him.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, and that's what keeps you guessing, because you're like, oh no, he actually is like a psychopath who has just kind of been feigning this I'm a doddery old man thing now. Especially in the beginning, I think, you know, when you're first introduced to Lila Loomis, there is this sense of like, oh no. And indeed later there's a sense of, oh no. But I do think it's not just a curio. I think it's a real little treat.
A strong recommendation from the desk for...
It's not often on Film Club we actually get to recommend the film we're talking about.
Exactly, yeah. Yes, that's Psycho 2. Go and watch it. Let us know what you think. And if you're going to dig deeper into Psycho 3 and 4 and the remake and Bates Motel, let us know how that journey goes.
I recently purchased a T-shirt from H&M of the Vince Vaughn Psycho poster, and I don't know why they were selling that. Like, who asked for a Gus Van Sant Psycho t-shirt? I think there may have been a confusion like in the office.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very glad I have it. I mean, I think that film is, again, utterly pointless, but you know, a great kind of like, well, okay, it's Halloween.
That's going to have to be another Film Club. Maybe for the next Stephen King film we can keep the Psycho Stephen King double bill going.
We'll get through all of them eventually,
and Anton will wheel you out for
like Anthony Perkins.
Yes. Anyway, Anton, Hannah, thank you so much for joining me this week. Next week we have The Irishman, Martin Scorsese's 3.5 hour long epic. Is that how long it is, Hannah?
It is, yeah. But the quickest, everyone keeps saying this, but it is the quickest 3.5 hours you'll ever spend.
Just rattles by like a theme park ride.
It does. Yeah, Scorsese would be so happy with that.
And then we have Driven.
Driven. It's about the man who invented the DeLorean.
Yes, it's one of the two John DeLorean films out this year. This is the one with...
Without Alec Baldwin.
Yes.
This is Jason Sudeikis and Lee Pace.
Lee Pace.
Two of Hannah's boys.
Oh, really? So Hannah's boys as opposed to Hannah's men. We don't need to discuss this on air.
We don't need to categorise.
One of Hannah's boys, indeed. And Film Club, because we're talking about Martin Scorsese, we're going to go back to the late 90s for one of, I think, his underrated gems, Bringing Out the Dead, starring Nicolas Cage. A great film, I think.
All-time Nicolas Cage performance in that.
A brilliant one, yes. Let us know what you think of those films at the usual channels. Once more, Hannah, Anton, thank you for joining me this week. I'm Michael Leader, and as always, this has been a 7 Digital production.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.